at this moment in time, of course, the ballroom is really the president's main priority.
Well, yeah, first things first. It's also my main priority as well.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
It's all of our priorities.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
What about the ballroom?
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
Good Lord.
And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yeah. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., also in California and Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains, KKRN, up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Richmond, Virginia's WRWK, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets and the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, Delmarva FM, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. Coming up with the 2025 off-year elections, now just days away, we will be joined by the great Harold Meyerson of the American Prospect to discuss a fascinating new proposal, actually, for the 2026 ballot out here in California for a wealth tax on the state's 200 billionaires. That Meyerson describes as the first politically viable wealth tax. Now, it's a unique proposal. It is unlike other so-called wealth taxes that we've seen forwarded in recent years by people like Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders, or even the so-called millionaires tax, an income tax increase for rich folks that is ostensibly on the ballot right now in Tuesday's off-year election for New York City mayor, where Democratic candidate 34-year-old Zoran Mamdani is proposing a progressive 2% income tax surcharge on individuals earning more than $1 million annually in order to help pay for his so-called affordability agenda items like universal child care, free city buses, more in the world's wealthiest city. So what makes the California proposal so unique that Meyerson describes it as the first politically viable wealth tax? Well, he'll be here to join us momentarily to explain exactly that and how, if it wins next year, if it wins voter approval next year, it could be expanded to other cities and states across the country. And
sounds good to me.
Yeah, I know it does. Why? You don't make more than $1 million a year, I'm guessing.
Surprise, I do not.
Of course, that is Desi Doyen. Hi, Des.
Hi.
Of course, we'll get Meyerson's thoughts on Mamdani and other big ticket issues on the ballot in the November 4 election. A bellwether, no doubt, for next year's critical midterms. But first, as we've been reporting this week, the record-breaking Hurricane Melissa continues to barrel its way north in the Atlantic after crash landing as a Category 5 in Jamaica on Tuesday, with wind speeds of 185 miles per hour, making it the most powerful storm on record to hit the island nation of Jamaica before it then moved up through Cuba. And now I believe into the Bahamas, where even as I believe it's currently as a Cat 3 at this point.
It's been downgraded to a Category 2.
All right. Nonetheless, it continues to threaten a lot of folks. Desi Doyen, of course, has been tracking the storm and its broken records and its deadly climate change fueled fallout very closely for our Green News Report, Desiree. What are you watching and learning about Melissa at this hour?
Well, first off, AP reports that Hurricane Melissa has left dozens dead and widespread destruction across Cuba and Jamaica and Haiti, and it's been knocking out power and it's forcing residents from their homes to evacuation shelters in towns that have been inundated. In Cuba, authorities say about 735,000 people remain in shelters where the storm made landfall as a Category 3. Overall, the storm has left 32 people dead, at least, across the Caribbean, 8 deaths in Jamaica, 1 in the Dominican Republic. The highest death toll, sadly, was in Haiti. It did not get a direct landfall from Melissa, but it was well within Melissa's range. And according to Haiti officials, at least 23 people have died from flooding. 10 remain missing after a river burst its banks and flooded homes, sweeping some of them away. AP also does say that the number of dead and missing in Haiti often fluctuates in the early days following major disasters.
Yeah, I was going to say, because I saw 25 dead.
And then
in,
it was 40, and now it's different. So we're not exactly sure, but we do know that many, many homes were swept away there. So, unfortunately.
And that was not even a direct hit in Haiti.
Right. And now, even though Melissa has been downgraded to a Category 2, as it continues to move northeast, it is growing in size. And so even if it doesn't make a direct landfall either on the Bahamas or elsewhere, it'll still affect them because they'll be within its range.
Is it growing in size because it's sort of beginning to break up and dissipate, or is it actually growing in...
It's growing in size, as I understand it, because the oceans are so hot that it's able to sustain it. So there is...
Right.
Still a chance that it could re-intensify like it did when it left Jamaica and moved to Cuba. It re-intensified and became a strong storm again.
Yep.
So it does have plenty of energy to keep it going. It's expected to pass just west of Bermuda and then head up to Nova Scotia. So for the U.S., no landfall is in the forecast, but there is likely to be impacts on the East Coast like high surf and rainfall.
Right. My understanding is that actually that there is a different storm system developing in the Northeast in the U.S. that could pull in some of that moisture from Melissa, making it a pretty wet and windy Halloween.
Yeah, sorry to all the kids who are going to have to deal with that on the East Coast. Now, on climate, yes, of course, as we've been covering quite a bit, climate change is making hurricanes more destructive, according to climate scientists, and Melissa is no different. From rising sea levels that increase storm surge to also ocean heat boosting rainfall intensity, because remember, a warmer atmosphere holds more moisture. Hurricanes today now produce 50% more precipitation because of climate change.
Really? 50%?
Yes, and by increasing wind speed and intensity, climate change also does that. Now, while climate change isn't increasing the overall number of tropical cyclones and hurricanes that we see, numerous studies are showing that climate change is increasing the intensity
right.
of the storms that do manage to form.
So more water, more stronger winds,
yes,
et cetera.
So storms are now more likely to reach Category 4 or 5 status than in the past. Melissa rapidly intensified at astonishing speed and continued to strengthen right up to landfall. Both of those things used to be rare, but today they happen way more frequently because of those record hot ocean waters. Remember, the ocean absorbs 90% of the heat of the planet that is being trapped by humanity's emissions of greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide and methane. That heat now extends hundreds of feet down into the ocean, providing ample fuel to sustain these storms, these really powerful storms like Melissa.
Because it used to be that one storm would sort of stir up the water enough that it would release the heat.
Right. That's how Earth redistributes heat. The sun beats down on the equator.
I knew that.
The ocean gets really hot.
Yeah.
And basically that creates more water vapor. That's the beginning brewing ingredients for hurricanes. And that is how, when they move northward, they bring all the heat out of the ocean. And that is how the planet redistributes that heat. Now, one of the things that you mentioned, Melissa, tying for the lowest pressure ever recorded, which indicates intensity. That means that no one since 1935 has experienced a storm as as strong as Melissa since 1935.
Really?
And finally, according to a rapid...
Do we know in 1935, or is that when they start? Was there a storm at that point, or was that when records started?
That was a record storm back in 1935, but this is based, as I understand it, this is based on instruments measuring pressure going back to at least 1900. According to the rapid attribution analysis by Climate Central, Melissa's record-shattering run would not have happened without climate change, which made the hurricane's winds about 10 miles per hour stronger and made the ocean temperatures that sustained its path 500 to 900 times more likely.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. Ah, yikes. All right. Well, thank you for that. If you are still in the way of Melissa out there, be careful no matter where you are, whether it's the Bahamas or Nova Scotia or the northeastern seaboard in the days ahead. And of course, the cleanup will take quite some time. It'll be interesting to see how much the Trump administration decides to help. I know that back in 1988, Hurricane Gilbert, the previous worst storm to ever hit Jamaica, that Ronald Reagan put a huge effort into a military effort and everything else into, helping the survivors in Jamaica back then. It'll be interesting to see what, if anything, the Trump administration does at this point.
Well, the State Department has said that it's going to send several disaster relief crews and urban rescue teams to these Caribbean islands, but I don't think that that's on the scale of what Ronald Reagan did.
Yeah, and I don't have time to go into it. I mean, but it was an enormous effort, including ships and helicopters, and it was an all-out effort because back then, even Republican presidents thought it was a good idea to, help out our neighbors, and that was a good long-term foreign policy idea.
Yeah, it's a good way to invest in goodwill around the world for the United States, which has now been pretty much squandered by the Trump administration.
Yes, used to be a good idea. Very good. Thank you very much, Des Doyne. One quick item of note here today before we get, speaking of the Trump administration and of man-made destruction, as the federal government shutdown now nears its second month and is seen as likely to become the longest federal government shutdown in U.S. history, surpassing the current record for longest shutdown, which was, during Donald Trump's last term of office. And as tens of millions of Americans are about to lose access to affordable health care, thanks to Trump and the Republicans' unprecedented cuts to health care, and as tens of millions of Americans are about to find themselves without access to supplemental food assistance, as of November 1, as the administration is choosing to withhold emergency contingency funding for SNAP as of now, funding that has already been appropriated by Congress, but the administration is choosing to not spend, choosing to starve people instead. And as essential federal workers are entering their second month of working without a paycheck, the president has, as White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt recently explained, one particular focus right now.
At this moment in time, of course, the ballroom is really the president's main priority.
There you go. First things first. That's the most important. The president's ballroom. Now, we've told you about how Trump last week tore down the entire East Wing of the White House without receiving approval from anyone, not from Congress or from the several commissions and councils who are supposed to sign off with approval on major renovations to the historic White House. Well, the administration has claimed that such approval is only needed for construction on the White House grounds, not for demolition. And last week, of course, they were only in the demolition phase, so they didn't have to get approval from anyone. They hadn't started building yet. And that we told you about that when they were ready for that phase, of course, they would certainly consult with various stakeholders like the Commission of Fine Arts, established by Congress more than a century ago, made up of a mix of architects and urban planners who are charged with providing advice to the president and Congress and local government officials on design matters related to construction projects in the Capital Region, like, for example, adding a ballroom to the White House. Its focus, including government buildings and monuments and memorials and, White House officials have traditionally sought the agency's approval for major projects of note. Well, as the Washington Post reports in an exclusive on Wednesday, the White House on Tuesday fired all six members of the Commission of Fine Arts, the independent federal agency that had been expected to review several of Trump's construction projects, including his planned triumphal arch, already being described as his Arc de Trump, and, of course, Trump's $350 million privately funded 90,000 square foot White House ballroom, the pet project whose footprint the historic East Wing of the White House was apparently getting in the way of. So we had to do away with that. An email reviewed by the Washington Post that was sent to one of the commissioners by a staffer, one of the commissioners on the Commission of Fine Arts by a staffer in the White House. Reads, quote, "On behalf of President Donald J. Trump, I'm writing to inform you that your position as a member of the Commission of Fine Arts is terminated, effective immediately." A White House official confirmed since then that all six members of the Commission of Fine Arts have now been terminated. Quote, "We are preparing to appoint a new slate of members to the commission."
I'm sure they will.
"That are more aligned with President Trump's America First policies," said the official. Bruce Becker, an architect who was appointed to the commission last year for a four-year term, was terminated on Tuesday. He praised the council's work in an interview on Tuesday night. He noted the agency, quote, "plays an important role in shaping the way the public experiences our nation's capital and the historic buildings it contains, which serve as symbols of our democracy." And by the way, if a 90,000 square foot ballroom does not serve as a symbol of our democracy, I don't know what does. And I'm not really kidding at this point. The White House in July also fired President Joe Biden appointees from the National Capital Planning Commission. That's another agency that is required to review external construction projects at the White House. Trump allies now make up a majority of that 12-member board, including its chair, Trump's own staff secretary. Imagine that. The White House has said that it will soon send Trump's ballroom plans to the National Capital Planning Commission, which will decide whether or not to approve the new building. Gosh, I wonder if they will or not. White House officials, meanwhile, have previously declined to comment on whether they planned to also send the plans to the Commission of Fine Arts and whether approval from that agency was necessary for the ballroom project to move forward. But I am guessing as soon as, you know, Trump seats six brand new handpicked members that they will, of course, do exactly that. Why wouldn't they? Because if there's anything that Trump is, it's a rule following type of guy. While certain historic precedents might allow the White House to sidestep the Commission of Fine Arts if they want to, it won't be as easy for Trump's gigantic Arc de Trump project that he is hoping to place in a prominent location among federal monuments in D.C. He won't be able to sidestep that review as easily as it seems that he can avoid the Commission on Fine Arts, even if they are stacked with his people. White House officials are considering building that arch on federal land that does not qualify for similar exemptions as the White House currently does. As a result, some of the fired commissioners had expected to play a role in reviewing that design. Silly commissioners. They also said that they had expected to review Trump's planned ballroom, expressing concern that the president abruptly tore down the East Wing last week without undergoing any review by their commission. Quote, "Were it not for today's terminations, the Commission on Fine Arts would look forward to a full review of the plans for the new structure that will replace the East Wing," said Becker, the architect who was appointed to the commission just last year and fired on Tuesday. Now, to be fair, President Biden in 2021 fired Trump appointees from the Commission of Fine Arts and the National Capital Planning Commission, with administration officials at the time defending the moves as an effort to try and diversify the panels. Then again, Joe Biden did not do so directly amid the demolition of a third of the White House in order to make way for the largest addition ever built at the People's House, or amid proposals for a major monument like a gigantic arch on the National Mall that no one had been asking for. Nonetheless, this is what autocracy looks like right now. Get used to it. At least until Americans get to have their say about such things at the ballot box, beginning next Tuesday in a number of states, and then next November in all 50 states around the country. Trump better start that construction quickly, it seems to me. Let's take a quick break here. We'll be joined by Harold Meyerson of the American Prospect on both next week's elections and on a fascinating proposal for next year's ballot out here in California that could, if all goes well, be coming for a rich person who lives near you. That's straight ahead on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At the broadcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Might.
Monday, 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 always Sunday in the rich man's world.
Yes, indeed. Welcome back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. A key race that a lot of Americans, including and perhaps especially wealthy Americans, are looking at in next week's 2025 November 4th off-year elections is Democratic candidate and frontrunner Zoran Mamdani's run for New York City mayor. Mamdani, a 34-year-old self-described Democratic socialist, is running on an affordability agenda campaign for average and lower-income New Yorkers, including proposals for a rent freeze, universal child care, free buses, city-owned grocery stores in food deserts across the five boroughs. A number of the programs that he's proposing would be paid for, he says, by an increase on taxes for the city's wealthiest residents and corporations. As part of his mayoral campaign, Mamdani proposes a 2% income tax surcharge on individuals earning over $1 million annually. Earning over $1 million annually, which his campaign estimates would raise some $4 billion per year from roughly 34,000 households in the city. He also advocates for an increase in the state corporate tax rate to match the one in neighboring New Jersey that is projected to generate an additional $5 billion annually for the city. Mamdani explained the taxes and why they are necessary as he sees it during an interview with Jon Stewart on The Daily Show this week.
Raising taxes on people who make $1 million, increasing it by just 2%, increasing the state's corporate tax rate to match that of the socialist utopia of New Jersey. These are things that are not just broadly popular. They right. also have precedence. And most importantly, though, you're not looking to do them in and of themselves. You're looking to do them to fund an affordability agenda that would transform quality of life for every New Yorker.
Right.
Now, for those who oppose the tax increase on the wealthiest residents of New York City because it is somehow unfair to them, Mamdani explained to NPR over the summer that the tax rate they would end up paying under his proposal is still much lower than it was in even very recent times.
Both of those groups of New Yorkers who make $1 million or more a year, or corporations that make millions in profits, would still pay less in taxes than they did before Trump's tax cuts in his first administration. And I say that because too often it's described as unrealistic when you have an ambition for working people and the way in which you'll pay for it. But it's actually firmly grounded in our precedent.
So what this so-called millionaire tax would do, Mamdani argues, is make the city's tax system more progressive, noting that the top 1% of earners currently take home 35% of all income in New York City. Meanwhile, critics of his proposal, such as New York's former governor Andrew Cuomo, who lost to Mamdani in the Democratic mayoral primary election a few months back, but is now running against him as an independent. Critics like Cuomo warn that such policies will drive wealthy residents and businesses out of the city, harming its tax base, even as Mamdani argues those concerns are greatly exaggerated. Now, if Mamdani is able to win, he is currently said to be leading both Cuomo and Republican candidate Curtis Sliwa in the polls. It could provide a fascinating experiment for such proposals, akin to those by former progressive presidential candidates like Bernie Sanders, who has endorsed Mamdani, and Elizabeth Warren, who has long proposed what she describes as a billionaire's tax, a wealth tax, which would impose a 2% annual levy on wealth over $50 million and 6% on wealth over $1 billion, targeting the top 0.1% of households in order to raise nearly $4 trillion over 10 years to pay for a whole bunch of programs, not unlike the ones perhaps that Zoran Mamdani is calling for in New York City. In the meantime, out here in California, as the American Prospect's Harold Meyerson reported last week, one of California's most powerful unions and two of the state's most prominent progressive economists unveiled a 2026 state ballot measure that would establish the nation's first statewide wealth tax. The union behind the proposal is SEIU's United Healthcare Workers West, whose members work in hospitals and clinics across the state. The economists are UC Berkeley's Emmanuel Saez and his progressive Berkeley colleague, Robert Reich, who served as the former Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton. The ballot measure that they unveiled is what they are describing as an emergency billionaire's tax aimed at making up the $100 billion hit to California's Medicaid program over the next 5 years that the Republican Congress and President Trump delivered to us, to our state, to all the other 49 as well, by enacting the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill that disproportionately cut taxes on the wealthy and reduced federal allotments for Medicaid in the bargain by $1 trillion, the largest such federal cut to healthcare funding in the nation's history. Also, that we could give more money to those rich people. Now, states work in partnership with the federal government to fund Medicaid for low-income residents, with the percent of the state-federal partnership varying in different states, depending on their wealth, etc. But in California, the state funds about 50% of Medi-Cal. That's our version of the federal Medicaid program. And the hit that we will see beginning next year is what the proponents of this rather unique California ballot measure proposal is meant to address. If the measure qualifies for the November 26 ballot and is then enacted by state voters, Meyerson explains, the initiative would levy a 5% tax on the wealth of the state's roughly 200 billionaires. And it would direct 90% of those funds to California's Medicaid recipients and the institutions that serve them, with the remaining 10% going to the state's K through 12 schools. But where proposals for millionaire and billionaire wealth taxes elsewhere by progressive folks, whether it's an income tax like Mamdani or wealth tax from Warren or Sanders, they have come under attack. But the California proposal, Meyerson argues, is constructed in a unique way that makes it what he describes as, quote, the first politically viable wealth tax. That said, it remains to be seen if Mamdani's proposal is or isn't politically viable. As noted, he's currently leading in the polls and is therefore still seen as likely to become the next New York City mayor based on this very proposal at the heart of his campaign. Nonetheless, his proposal would still require approval from multiple layers of government, including both the New York City Council and the state legislature, if it is to be enacted, if Mamdani wins. So what makes the California proposal the first politically viable wealth tax, as Meyerson describes it? Let's ask him. Harold Meyerson is the editor-at-large of the very progressive American Prospect magazine, where he's been an editor since 2001. He also served for many years as a weekly columnist for the Washington Post and also contributes to the LA Times and other national publications. Oh, Mr. Meyerson, it has been far too long, but welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
Very glad to be here, Brad. And before I get into the California thing, I would like to just digress for a minute about Mondami's proposal.
Yeah.
It makes sense that it has to go through the city council. The reason it has to go to the legislature is the legacy of the mid-1970s fiscal crisis of New York, which transferred to the state level the city's sort of taxes and spending, particularly the taxes. So. Uh-huh. It's the legacy of that. Now, I will point out that the latest count of Mamdani precinct walkers, phone bankers, et cetera, is 90,000. And if that group can stay together, and I'm sure if he wins that Mamdani will want that group to stay together, it can exert significant pressure on Democratic Assembly and State Senate members, which is, roughly speaking, the way to get the state to agree to the millionaire super tax in New York and, you know, therefore fund affordable child care for, you know, the gazillions of parents who are having trouble affording it.
Right. And well, there are some additional questions I want to ask you about Mamdani, if we have time.
Sure.
Related to what you say, but let me start here for a second in California, because I'm glad you brought this to my attention as one of many, I suspect, proposals that we will be seeing from states as we move forward, as we hopefully move toward what I'm already calling the second reconstruction to either, you know, survive or rebuild eventually from this from the various nightmares of the Trump era. So how is the California proposal different, more politically viable, as you describe it, than similar-ish wealth tax proposals we've seen from, you know, folks like Mamdani and Warren, et cetera? What makes this sort of in a different category, it seems, than those other proposals as you see it?
Well, the argument against wealth taxes generally is that it will cause very wealthy people to leave the jurisdiction, in this case, to leave the state, and deter other very wealthy people from moving in. This is the argument that the wealth tax proposal in California answers in the following way. First, it only applies to the wealth of people for this year, calendar 2025. And it can the tax, which is a 5% tax on wealth, can be paid over the spread out over the next 5 years, assuming the tax were would be enacted in November 2026. It takes effect in 2027. If you move into the state and you're, you know, ridiculously wealthy, anytime after the end of this year, you're not. This doesn't apply to you. It's not covered because it only applies to the wealth of this year. And also, if you move out of the state and you have you have a certain huge billionaire wealth threshold that you pass this year, you're still liable under the terms of this tax for paying it. So it's structured in such a way that it eliminates the argument that it'll cause billionaires to move out because it only applies to billionaires in the state as of this year. and that it will keep billionaires from moving in, because assuming they move in after December 31st of this year, it doesn't apply to them. It's directed specifically, that amount of money is directed specifically at the Medicaid shortfalls, which will, you know, we're beginning to see a version of, but only a partial version of, as a result of the big, beautiful Republican bill which slashed Medicaid, and which is a threat to California hospitals, particularly in rural areas. So it is, as it were, a limited wealth tax in the sense that it is directed at filling the gap created by these cutbacks in Medicaid, and in the sense that it only applies to billionaires this year in California.
So it's sort of a one and done situation,
yes,
at least for now. And this is, I note that, you know, one of Andrew Cuomo's arguments against Mom Donnie's proposal in New York is that it will cause wealthy people, like you said, to flee the city and thus decrease the tax base and the overall economic health, perhaps even more hurting the economy more than it helps. At least that seems to be the argument from Cuomo. But that is just removed from this proposal by making it a one-year thing, and doesn't matter what anybody leaves or comes, they're still liable for it.
Exactly. And I would also take on Cuomo's contention vis-a-vis Mandami's proposal in New York, because it only applies to New Yorkers' income, yearly income, when that income goes over $1 million. It applies, it raises the tax on income over $1 million from 11 point something percent to 13 point something percent.
Right.
I actually think that the effect of that increase on New York's very wealthy is so relatively negligible that if anyone moves, it's because they can't stand cold winters anymore, but has nothing to do with this tax surcharge.
You explain in your piece at TAP that the California proponents of the measure out here argue that 72% of the 200 billionaires' wealth is in their ownership of publicly traded stock. So those sums are easily calculable by the state. All right, they're easily calculable because they have to be reported on income taxes and so forth. But as I'm sure those wealthy folks would still argue, Harold, that also means that those are not yet realized gains, that those are stock market values that could fall or even plummet in an economic downturn. They'll argue, I suspect, that, you know, until they cash out that publicly traded stock, that they shouldn't be taxed on it. We hear that a lot in response to various wealth tax proposals. Why is that argument wrong?
Well, that is still a form of wealth, and one of the basic realities of what has happened to the American economy over the last 40 years is a redistribution of income and wealth from wages to stock holding, to shareholding, to dividends, to stock buybacks, what have you, that raise that value, and comes at the expense of you know, workers whose wages are in often an inverse relationship to the level that corporations devote to their shareholders. I would point out that as we speak, in the last 24 hours, NVIDIA has become the first company that whose the market value of their shares exceeds $5 trillion, just as in the last 24 hours, Microsoft has exceeded the $4 trillion level, even as these giant companies like Amazon, UPS, General Motors are laid off, all of them combined, have laid off probably about 40,000 workers in the same 24-hour period.
Yes.
Who exactly is stock appreciation helping? It is, anyone who has a 401k has a small share in the market, but it disproportionately helps the very wealthy whose taxes were reduced in the very same bill, the big, beautiful bill, that reduced the funds available for Medicaid. So this is sort of an evening out, an attempt to even out at a modest scale, what the one beautiful bill did for the very rich and against people who need help just covering their health care.
Another argument against this measure, I suspect, is that, and you know, even though this is a one and done sort of one time additional tax, basically on 2025 wealth to help cover that one big beautiful cut to Medicaid of about $1 trillion, and to the Medi-Cal program out here, that's the California version of Medicaid, that opponents will say that, look, if this is successful, if this is adopted by voters next year in 26, it'll only apply to 2025, but it will be done again and again, maybe enacted permanently next time. Is there anything not true about that argument? If we're trying to level the playing field here, why not make it permanent next time?
Indeed, why not? And, you know, if you look at the public support for raising taxes on the very rich, it is a very high level of support. It is a bipartisan level of support. Mm. And, you know, if we want an economy that at all resembles the more broadly shared prosperity of the first three decades after World War II, we have to rebalance the teeter-totter between shareholder income and worker income if this is going to be, you know, if we're going to even attempt to recreate a version of the mass middle class of the middle of the 20th century.
That middle class, of course, unprecedented growth in the nation was also at the same time that there was a 91% upper tax bracket. So I guess some of these rich people can survive it. You also note that none of the provisions here that make this more politically viable than other similar measures will actually prevent opponents from decrying it anyway as, you know, socialism, because as I understand it, that's a very, very bad thing, Harold, at least when it adversely affects millionaires and billionaires and corporations. So is that enough, the specter of the dreaded socialism, to actually kill a measure like this at the ballot box in a state like California, especially when it is meant to fund, you know, socialist programs like Medicaid and the public school system?
Right. Well, you know, there was certainly a time in American and California history when that accusation carried greater weight than it does now, due to the Soviet Union, due to the Red Scare of the mid-1950s, which blocked a very kind of really attractive public housing program in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. It doesn't carry the weight that it once did. Young Americans in poll after poll give a higher approval rating to socialism, whatever they think that may be, than they do to capitalism, which they've actually experienced.
Yeah.
I don't think that will fly. You know, I also keep in mind the American right has attacked liberal proposals going back to Franklin Roosevelt as socialistic, and you know, in attacking Social Security, they had a point. It is a clearly social democratic program. The most popular government programs remain Social Security and Medicare. By the way, people forget that Ronald Reagan came to political notice in the 2 years before he first ran for governor in 1966. By saying, you know, Medicare, which was then a proposal before Congress, would pave a socialist path for America that we should never go down. Right. So these are time-honored attacks. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. I think they have a lot less power now than they once did.
And in a state like California, you make an interesting case, Harold Meyerson, that a proposal like this might actually be a net positive in a, you know, a heavily blue-leaning state like California, that the simple presence of this measure on next year's midterm ballot would have a big effect on turnout in 2026. So much so, you note that even conservative billionaires on next year's ballot, for example, likely gubernatorial candidate Rick Caruso, who was formerly a Republican, then an independent, now he's claiming to be a Democrat, because I guess you have to be a Democrat to win governor these days, it seems, that even folks like Caruso, with something like that on the ballot, would find themselves very seriously needing to consider if they want to support such a measure in order to be politically viable in a state like California.
If he were to run for governor and that proposal qualifies for the ballot next June to be voted on in November when the governor's election will be on the ballot, it would look awfully self-interested and against the interests of those Californians, of whom there are gazillions, reliant upon Medi-Cal, a state versus Medicaid, if he were to oppose it, or B, even to, you know, not take a stance on it. You know, the optics would look pretty damn bad.
Yes, that would be true with a billionaire like that. You also suggest that this might be a model, if it's successful, might be a model for Democrats in both states and cities elsewhere that may have a, pardon the pun, a wealth of rich people and large, you know, profitable corporations, that they might see this as a model for their own jurisdiction. Does this apply elsewhere? In California, we're talking about, as large as the state is, apparently this tax would only apply to 200 people. Could you do this elsewhere?
Well, clearly you could do it in New York. Okay. You know, you could do it on a lesser scale, I think, just going by cities. You could do it in Chicago. You could do it in Boston. You couldn't do it in Fargo. You wouldn't get far doing it in Des Moines. Mm. If billionaire is the cutoff point, they do tend to concentrate in specific areas. But where they do concentrate, you can do it. And B, maybe, you know, someone could decide billionaire isn't the cutoff point. 500 million is the cutoff point. So, you know, it can be a model one way or another in any city or any state with some concentration of the very rich.
I don't know why you're picking on these poor people that only have $500 million, Harold. Looking ahead to next week's off year elections, we discussed Mom Donnie a little bit. His proposal, of course, is not a one and done 1 year thing, but a permanent change to the New York City tax structure. It would, as we discussed, have to be approved both by the city and the state if he is to win next week. Should I presume from your description of the California proposal for wealth tax as the first politically viable one that you don't think his proposal is actually viable?
Well, it's not a wealth tax; it's an income tax. So, in that sense, it doesn't break. It doesn't break conceptual new ground. I think it is politically viable, particularly because it's specifically directed at making child care universal and affordable. I haven't really heard any persuasive arguments as to why child care shouldn't be that. I mean, we do it for children from, roughly speaking, the ages of 5 to 18. That's called public schools. Mm-hmm. But we also know simultaneously that the most important formative years for children is, you know, right after birth up to age 5, and we don't do it for that. So it would seem, you know, A, very counterproductive in general. B, it really addresses a huge screaming need, which is the, parents trying to afford childcare for their kids. I speak as a grandparent with a 3.5-year-old grandson who is helping my daughter and her husband pay for his child, you know, his going to preschool. Mm-hmm. And that is a lot of money. That's why I'm helping them with that and not other things. And this is, you know, this is so common in America today. You know, so we keep talking about you know, will this cause a handful of millionaires to leave New York? Well, how many families in New York that have to deal with this, you know, would benefit by this? It is, you know, hundreds of times the number of millionaires, believe me, who have to pay that tax and may then therefore consider leaving the city.
Well, while we're on the topic, it's of New York City. It's been kind of stunning to watch establishment Democrats like New York Governor Kathy Hochul, Democratic U.S. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries of New York, wait until I think it was just last week or this week to actually endorse Mamdani. What is that about, as you see it? I mean, he's the Democrat in the race, and they all sort of say, well, we'll support the Democrat, but this guy has, as you said, 90,000 volunteers out there. He has obviously excited the electorate. What is this all about, these establishment Democrats who seem to have such a difficult time getting behind the Democratic candidate in New York City?
A lot of it is about their funders. These are people who raise a great deal of money in Kathy Hochul's case for the next gubernatorial race. And in Hakeem Jeffries' case for the House Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. And they get a disproportionate amount of their money from, not surprisingly, the very rich. And it's, you know, if there is a native constituency opposed to Mamdani, the core of that is the very rich. So I think that was one of the thumbs on the scale. And, you know, they had to weigh that against clearly the overwhelming support of registered Democrats, their own party, for Mamdani. You know, I'd also point out that the chair of the New York State Democratic Party, who was, not surprisingly, appointed years ago by Andrew Cuomo, has vociferously opposed the Mamdani campaign. So, I mean, there are all kinds of factors in here, including concerns of disproportionately older Jewish voters about the Israel, his stance on Israel-Palestine and so on. But, you know, they're holding back. And, of course, the state's two senators, Chuck Schumer and Kirsten Gillibrand, have not endorsed him at all. Rather, it's not a question of belatedly, it's a question of not at all. And so they, too, are disproportionately reliant on very rich contributors, disproportionately in the state of New York, of course.
And disproportionately out of touch, it seems, with their own electorate, at least in New York City. And I know we're not in the predictions business, Harold, but do you think, first, that Zorin will be able to pull this off next week? And if so, more importantly, do you think that will mean that he has a mandate to, in fact, enact the many progressive policies that he's been running at least so effectively on, and that, as noted, will require the state legislature to get behind him, even though we're only talking about New York City?
Well, there were two questions, and the short answer is yes and yes. I think he will win. I don't think the margin may be as wide as it people have been heralding. I think, you know, if he wins, he's not going to win by 15 or 20 points. That would surprise me. If he wins by 10 or even 6 or 7 or 8, he will still win. And, you know, he has been very careful in coming up with his platform, which really deals almost exclusively with economic issues that have very broad support in New York City. Freezing the rent, free bus rides, affordable childcare being at the core of those issues. You know, look, I mean, he picked an affordability agenda, which frankly is what, you know, the moderate Democrats currently running for governors of New Jersey and Virginia, respectively, are running on too. So it's very clear that he's staked out his terrain, and he has consciously avoided a lot of issues, the culture war issues and so on. So by having, you know, that carefully crafted a platform on which he's run, yes, he can certainly claim a mandate for those proposals. They're at the core of his political identity, and they have a hell of a lot of support.
Finally, there are, of course, also critical off-year elections next week for governor in New Jersey and Virginia, along with the entirety of the Virginia's House of Delegates is on the ballot. And, of course, the big Prop 50 statewide measure out here in California to redraw our state's U.S. House maps to flip five seats from red to blue next year in response to the Texas legislature rewriting their gerrymandered U.S. House map to flip five seats from blue to red. So before I let you go, Harold, what in particular will you be looking for next week, or are you expecting coming out of the last major election day before next year's critical midterms?
Well, I think the Democrats will win all of those races. I expect New Jersey, will be fairly close. You know, New Jersey only has two media markets, New York City and Philadelphia. So they've been seeing a ton of the Mondami and anti-Mondami ads. Mm. And there's a lot of folks in New Jersey who have the politics of a lot of folks on Long Island, whose main identity is we fled the, this minority-clogged city. I think Jersey will be close, but I think Mickey Sherrill will win in Jersey and Abigail Scamberger will win in Virginia, and the Democrats will hold the legislature in Virginia, which, by the way, means that they'll be able to do some pro-Democratic redistricting in Virginia as well. Mm-hmm. Prop 50 is clearly going to pass, and whether you're a moderate Democrat who's really invested in Scamberger and Sherrill, or a left Democrat who's invested in Zoran Mondami, you're going to have a good night.
Well, we will see. Harold Meyerson, he is the editor-at-large of the American Prospect magazine, where he does a whole bunch of really good stuff. Just put out an article about how, yes, the state of Montana is pushing back against Citizens United. We don't have time to talk about that today, but I look forward to that in the future. You can find his work over there at prospect.org. Harold Meyerson, always a delight speaking with you, sir. It's been too long. Let's not make it so long until we speak again.
That sounds like a good deal, Brad. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, sir. All right, we got to get out, but it's nice to hear that he's rather bullish on Democrats. We'll see if he's right. He's very smart on these things.
Yes, he is. He's given me a lot to think about.
And the idea that Chuck Schumer and Kirsten Gillibrand have yet to endorse the Democratic candidate for New York City mayor is absolutely mind-boggling to me. Mind-blowing.
Yeah. They do have very wealthy donors that they are also keeping in high consideration.
Yeah, I guess putting them first before the voters. We'll see how that works out for Chuck Schumer next year. Yeah. All right, we got to get out for now. Thanks again to Harold Meyerson. Thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen. And thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It's always an honor and greatly appreciated. If you missed any portion of today's show or want to share anything from it with your friends, your family, your enemies, you can do so for free at bradblog.com. We do not have the wealthy voters that Chuck Schumer does, so I'm hoping when you stop by bradblog.com, you might hit one of those donate buttons or go straight to bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves. Drop me an email. Always good to hear from you. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the social medias, especially Blue Sky, you will find me at The Brad Blog. We will see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.